Twofootedtackle.com.
Never mind the Balkans, here's the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Yes, we'll be picking over the snooze fest. It was England versus Montenegro. Utter pants was the verdict, even though Mirko Vucinic wasn't playing. Plus, 11 Scottish men abroad and failing to be offensive shocker. The Tartan Army packed the park against the Czechs. We'll also be tuning in to the latest from the Liverpool soap opera and covering all your favourites like the MLS, the FA Cup and the Premier League here on the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Yes, hello, and welcome to the Two Footed Tackle podcast with me, Gary Andrews, and with a man who won't be spoiling your enjoyment of the pod by hacking like an angry Alsatian this week, Chris Nee. How are you feeling, Chris?
I feel like $1 million, Gary, thank you.
Excellent. All the lurgy gone out?
Yeah, I think I got most of it out in the studio last week.
Excellent, good stuff. Did anybody have to use the studio after us?
We had a client in yesterday, and we did the European Football Special podcast also yesterday, but no one immediately afterwards.
Okay, so your germs aren't going to be virulently throughout the building?
No, I hope not.
Excellent. That's good. That's good. It's also a welcome return to the pod for a man whose record at Wembley reads 2 matches, no England goals, 1 point. The Three Lions lucky charm, ITV.com's Luke McLaughlin.
Thank you. Yes, quite true. I'm still smarting from my experience at Wembley on Tuesday night, and indeed, smarting from my experience there about 10 years ago, the first England game I ever saw at Wembley.
Excellent stuff. Well, not excellent stuff, really. I guess, are you tempted just not to go again?
I'll go again because it can't be as bad as the first two that I've seen over the course of over the course of 10 years, I should say.
Which was the first one?
It was the Euro 2000 qualifier that we lost against Scotland when Scholes had scored 2 goals in the away leg. And we lost the home leg 1-0, you might remember, and under Keegan. And it was similarly clueless as this week.
Brilliant. Well, that seems to be the first place to start, really. England, Montenegro. As you said, you were at Wembley. So, just how bad it was. Plenty of booing at the end. Was it justified?
I think so, yes. There was an opinion in the aftermath, oh, well, it wasn't such a bad result and so on. That's quite true. It wasn't such a bad result, but it was a bad performance, in my opinion. I think that the 4-4-2 formation is extremely predictable. You know, it's so tiresome saying these things. We've been saying them for it seems, a long time now. And I think there are real problems with the England team. I think that the balance in midfield is wrong. I think, and I don't think you can blame Wayne Rooney. Okay, he's not playing particularly well, but I don't think Rooney is the problem. I think the problems are much more than that.
So what were the problems then against Montenegro?
I think the main problem, if I were to pinpoint one thing, is that the balance of the midfield is wrong, in the sense that if you're going to play Steven Gerrard, he needs to play in an advanced role. He doesn't look comfortable playing in a central two with the likes of Gareth Barry, and particularly on the form Gareth Barry showed on Tuesday. But I think it was depressingly obvious in the first few minutes that Gerrard didn't look comfortable. He started spraying around those passes, 4 or 5 of which went astray. The one which got to Peter Crouch was a total mishit, and everyone wrote that up in the papers, or a lot of writers wrote that up as a superb pass. I was sitting right behind it. It was an utter mishit, and that summed it up for me, is that Gerrard just isn't playing in the right position. He's playing virtually out of position, despite playing in central midfield. And okay, Lampard was absent, which, depending on your viewpoint, my viewpoint is that's a good thing. And still, Gerrard isn't playing at his best because he's not playing in the position he should be. He should be playing off Wayne Rooney or an other.
Chris, do you think it could have been a slightly different story? It could have been even a loss if Vucinic had been playing.
Well, I actually got asked this question, the exact same question last night, and I think it probably would have been.
You can tell I haven't listened to that pod yet.
No,
I haven't had a chance.
It's obviously the clearest question to ask about their performance, because they were okay. I think they were below par from what they've done so far in this competition. And I do think that with Vucinic, and let's not be clear, Vucinic isn't just their best player. He is a star of world football. He is one of the very best strikers in Serie A. And I really do think that he would have been able to pick us off. They were missing a couple of players, and to be honest, with the DC United boy as the main threat, they were never going to score. But they do have players that were missing that would have given us real problems.
To me, it felt almost like a Serie A game, with two teams trying to feel each other out, being sort of quite cautious. And I was surprised when, on the 60th minute, say, Capello didn't start trying to tell them to turn up the screw, because I don't have a problem with watching Serie A type games. I think there's nothing wrong with that. But then seeing it go into sort of later on, having that
just lack of urgency throughout. That surprised me.
Yeah, it was funny because we nobody really did in the end underestimate them. I think there was we sort of almost went a little bit the other way, but on the night we should have won that game because we passed the ball better. A lot of the Gerrard passes were there and going astray. A lot of the little passes, you know, 20 odd yards from defence into midfield, they were hospital balls, and we just didn't really get any kind of traction on the game at all. And a good performance from England, even, you know, whatever you want to say about the squad or the prospects that we have or anything, the players that were on the pitch are better than they displayed. And this is the story of England over the last 10 years anyway. And if they were hitting their passes, if they were making sure that all of those met their targets, concentrating a little bit more, had a little bit of a better final pass and were able to finish, we would have won that game, even against what is proving to be a very decent side.
Luke, it's not the end of the world, though. Montenegro have played one more game than England. England, if they won their game in hand, would be level with Montenegro. Better goal difference than Montenegro. Still got to play other teams. Switzerland, Bulgaria and Wales have shown that they are eminently beatable. It's not a total disaster. Could it be just put down as a one-off? England have got through qualifying under Capello before with minimum of fuss.
That's true, but no, it can't be put down as a one-off because it's not as if a poor performance has materialised out of nowhere. Yes, they had a bright start to this qualifying campaign, but I'm sorry to mention the World Cup. They were woeful at the World Cup for most of it, for almost all of it. So no, it's not a one-off, and I also think it's dangerous to say, well, you know, we'll be okay, we'll beat Wales, you know, home and away, or that's what people seem to be thinking, and I don't think that's a given at all. I think you need to win your home games in qualifying, especially when you have an easy group like England did. And they made very heavy weather of getting through that group at the World Cup, and I worry that now that they're going to make extremely hard work. If they play like they did on Tuesday, rest assured they probably won't even qualify. I mean, and I don't think that's an exaggeration because I think it was a really poor performance. And I think you have to take the performance. You know, yes, a 0-0 draw against a team who's won three games on the bounce is not a bad result in itself. But the performance was poor. And as Chris says, they were under strength anyway. You know, Vucinic almost would have made a difference. He would have made a difference to the bet I made before the game, which I still haven't got my money back for, which was Vucinic to score first before he pulled out with an injury.
Unfortunate stuff. Chris, so... Harry Redknapp today, who you mentioned on the Two for the Tackle blog, says that the solution is to get more long balls up to Crouch, get Lampard in as playing with a little trio in there with Gerrard, Lampard and Rooney. Now, for all the obvious foibles which you have pointed out on the blog, we won't necessarily get into that too much, but do you think that's still a problem because that is the English way of thinking? Oh, you know, let's just get the balls up to the big fella, whether it's Crouch, whether it's Davies, let's get our best players in there, that's all we really need. Do you think Harry's kind of more of a symptomatic, symptomatic symbolism, I guess you could say, of the way that England's mentality is throughout the press, forcing that kind of pressure onto the players.
Yeah, I think he is. You know, this long ball thing, we're not a long ball team, we're direct at times, and we do tend to play with that kind of player up front. We need to get rid of that because it clearly doesn't work and it forces a formation that also doesn't work. And in general, this short-termism on this England team is going to get us nowhere. We can't see just qualifying for this competition as a success. No matter how we do in this, getting there isn't a success anymore. And sorry to keep beating the drum like I was all summer. We need to be forgetting 2012. We need to forget 2014. And we need to really start looking towards the future. Frank Lampard, for all the talk that Harry's been doing today about how he thinks that he can play together with Gerrard, how he thinks that there should be this golden triangle which magically pulls Rooney back into a 4-5-1. For all of that, Frank Lampard should not be playing in the England team anymore. He's too old and we should be looking much further into the future. And I say that as a huge fan of Frank Lampard as a club footballer. We look better without him in the England team. Even in the short term, it showed up very clearly in the Hungary friendly when he went off that we were a different team. Stephen Gerrard was a different player in that game as well. Obviously, that's not going to happen every time. And I really do think that we need to just forget Frank Lampard. We need to forget Crouch, Heskey, Davies. And I appreciate what you're going to say about Davies, and I agree. But I think his inclusion is absolutely symptomatic of a real lack of progressiveness in England's setup at the moment.
Just a stopgap. Anyway, Luke, We had a couple of questions come in, and I've forgotten to write down the names of the people, so I do apologise.
Can I just respond to Chris's point there very quickly? Because I do actually, for the first time tonight, disagree with you on one thing there. I mean, I agree with you on the older players. I agree with you that the time has come to drop the likes of Lampard and Kevin Davies, arguably, after his debut. But I think this idea that you disregard Euro 2012 or even the next World Cup is nonsense, to be honest, because I think there is a that presupposes that England would be good enough to win one of the following tournaments, and I don't think actually we are. I don't think there's any evidence to say that we will be going to tournaments and saying we're good enough to win this. So international tournaments are big deals. The Euros are big deals. The World Cup's a big deal, and I think that we should be trying to do our best at every one of them. And I also think that there's no reason why you can't get the young players in now and have a crack at winning Euro 2012. Yeah, don't say, oh, let's get the young players in and forget Euro 2012. You know, get them in now, get them in the qualifying matches and the friendlies, and go and have a crack at it, like Germany did in the World Cup.
Of course, I want to go to those tournaments and give it a crack. I want to qualify for them. But that's right. I want to do it with the players that we want to be going to 2016, 2018.
Sure.
Because those are the guys. I mean, it doesn't matter. They're probably in their late teens now. And most of them, in another country, would be good enough to go to the major tournaments as the first team as it is. And I think we should be starting to bring those players that we have through.
Yeah.
And there aren't loads of them. But why not give them the chance to qualify for the next competition and then go to the next competition, presuming they qualify for it?
It seems to me that, if taking the example of Germany, that Jürgen Klinsmann, their former manager, is getting a huge amount of credit for effectively having a clear out and saying, right, we're starting a new slate, we're going to get some new players in. You look at guys like Müller and Ozil and Badstuber and those guys who've come in and done fantastically well. We probably have got equally as talented players. So I absolutely agree with you that we need to look to the future, but the future is 2 years from now, not four or six.
That brings actually nicely onto one of the questions we're asked. So, say, I'm very sorry I didn't take down your names. I completely forgot to put them down. So, you know who you are, and take a small glow of satisfaction that the question's been asked. But Adam Johnson was asked. Is he the real deal, or is this just kind of building up hype over one of young players?
I think it's a little bit early to judge him overall. I think he looked very good. He's obviously been on an upward curve for a long time, broke into the Man City team and looked very good. And I think he looks very promising. I think he can beat a man. He's quick. He seems to take the right decision when he gets in behind a defence, whether it be a cut back or having a shot. And I think he's got a lot of promise. Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't say yes, he will be on the England wing for 10 years, but he's got loads of promise.
And the other question was, Gareth Barry, can you do anything other than just stand in the centre circle and knock balls around? Not very well.
Well, he's been on very average form for a long time, perhaps since this injury. Someone made a very good point around the time of the World Cup, which was that he seemed to turn into Claude Makélélé while he was injured. Everyone said, oh, we need Gareth Barry back in because he's world class. And He does have a habit of looking very ordinary, and if I was managing England, I'd play Scott Parker in that role. But that's just me.
I wouldn't disagree with that. If I was managing England, I would also play Scott Parker in that role. Elsewhere in the group, the less said about Wales, the absolute better. So as far as I say, I can see us getting through that entire campaign without getting a single point on the board.
Did you see the games?
I've seen highlights.
Any good?
No.
Nothing. Nothing at all.
Were Wales any good?
No. No positives.
No. Not really.
Excellent.
At all.
And cracking new manager on the way.
Well, yeah, apparently Ian Rush wants the job, which, given his record at Chester City, now I'm not disparaging Ian Rush at all because he's a fantastic player, one of the best natural goal scorers I've seen, fantastic player for Wales, but his managerial record at Chester was poor. I've seen nothing to convince that he should be able to do the job. If you want to bring in somebody who's a Welsh legend, put John Hartson in instead. If nothing else, he will certainly get the players up for it.
I think the point is that Flynn has the backing of the players, as far as I can see. Gareth Bale came out and said that he'd do a fantastic job or brilliant job or something like that. So it seems to me, if you're making a decision around what the players want, then which would be healthy, then maybe appoint Flynn.
Yeah, but he's got the backing of the players. But on the other hand, he's... with all due respect, again, I like Brian Flynn. I think he's done a fantastic job with the under-21s, and I think that's probably the best place for him. People get very misty-eyed over how good a player he was and sort of how committed he was to the Welsh cause as a player. But his managerial record, again, is not particularly outstanding. It's lower league stuff. Wales can do better than that.
Yeah.
Yes, he has the backing of the players. A lot of those players will have been brought through and almost fast-tracked into the senior squad by Flynn. It's understandable they'll have a lot of appreciation. To me, I see Brian Flynn a bit like Kevin McDonald at Villa.
Yeah.
Comes through, players really like him, keep him in the setup, value his opinion, but have somebody else in charge who either will be getting the players up for it or preferably is a little bit more tactically astute than playing one up front, Steve Morrison up front at home against a Bulgaria team who should have been there for the taking. Is my considered opinion.
Very good. I was impressed with that.
Doesn't happen.
I vote for you.
I can do quite well on Championship Manager. Of course, the other big story, Chris, in international football this week, Serbia. Their game against Italy called off because of crowd trouble. Looks mostly from now... story seems to be that it is the Serbians who caused the trouble, but I mean, have you ever heard of anything or seen anything like that? It's been a long, long time since we've had these kind of scenes in international qualifying.
Yeah, well, of course, for long-term football fans, the scenes are sadly familiar, but this political undertone is something I've certainly not that familiar with, and it's really quite worrying, particularly for Serbia. Because it's, you know, we can't separate this from football. We had James in last night, and he's done a lot of research into the supposed hooligans, and they are very much intertwined with football and also with the politics of the country. There's obviously a huge flux in that situation at the moment, and it is obviously spilling over into football. But these are, I mean, we're talking about football hooligans who were just strongly linked with Arkan. You know, this is the two are just not able to be separated, and that's really worrying.
Absolutely. Luke, what would be your punishment that you would hand down if you were UEFA? Because clearly something has to be done about it. Serbia obviously seem, the nation themselves or the politicians seem absolutely mortified by this, but what can UEFA do?
Well, I think what UEFA can do is they can take action on the basis that what the surprising thing was, after it happened, it seemed to me that the sources in Serbia were saying, yeah, we knew that was going to happen. We knew they were planning it. We knew they were going to Italy. We knew it was going to happen, and it happened, and which I found surprising because... maybe they need to make sure, UEFA can try and make sure that they have to get their act together when it comes to trying to stop known... those elements travelling, because that's how there has been a great degree of success, certainly with England fans. I think doing that in the, you know, looking at our own experience, if you know that people are playing in trouble, then stop them going in the first place, or do something to try and head them off at the pass, because that it just really surprised me that, and the Italians I think are blaming, you know, very much pointing the finger at the Serbian authorities for knowing what was going to happen and not really doing enough to stop it, and clearly they didn't do enough to stop it because it all unfolded exactly as they expected.
Chris, where does this leave Serbian football?
Well, it leaves it for a start in a pretty difficult situation in qualifying, because presumably the 3 points will end up very shortly in Italy's pocket, which puts Serbia's qualification under threat. And after their qualification for the last couple of World Cups, that's going to be a real issue for them. But obviously there is a far more serious situation, and they are going to end up presumably having games played behind closed doors. They may have to play outside Serbia. And for what a lot of people consider to be a burgeoning football nation and a lot of people's dark horses to do well in the World Cup, obviously they didn't really quite live up to that. It's a real setback. So I would be genuinely concerned. In terms of their punishment, it's really difficult. We talk about this quite a lot, and whenever these things happen, the obvious ones aren't the right punishments, because you are playing into the hands of the people. You know, they want to get the games cancelled. They want to get these teams kicked out of tournaments. And if you just hand it to them on a plate, then you're really not sticking up to it at all. So it's going to have to be some kind of alternative. There's no point in fining them. UEFA are absolutely pitiful when it comes to fining countries. So it's going to have to be behind closed doors. It's going to have to be overseas games. And obviously Italy should get the points. Italy haven't quite escaped censure yet, I don't think, because it's their stadium and their country, and they're ultimately responsible for what happens. And also, I believe the Serbian authorities are suggesting that they knew all of what Luke said they knew and told the Italian authorities as well. So it looks to be a pretty complicated situation, but I don't think expulsion is really the right answer.
I would have thought, actually, I mean, looking much further down the line, one ultimate beneficiary of this could, in pure footballing terms, if we're talking footballing terms here, could be Montenegro, because there's a lot of Serbian players who are also eligible for Montenegro, and they might look at the situation and go, I'd rather play for Montenegro now than Serbia. And that could hurt Serbia, certainly in the next couple of tournaments. Could take them a very, very long time to recover from this, both on the field and off the field. Before we go on to Scotland, which we will in a minute, a quick word, Chris, for Northern Ireland as well. One minute they get a brilliant draw against Italy, the next less than stellar draw against the might of the Faroe Islands.
Yeah, I don't know about a brilliant draw with Italy.
Well, it's a good point.
Great result good for point. Them, but good my point. God, that was a poor game. They could have won it. They had the best chance of the game. Italy managed to carve out a few, had lots more possession. But David Healy's header was the real gilt-edged chance in that game, and he should have put it away.
Right, let's turn our attentions to Scotland now. Who better to talk us through their games against the Czech Republic and Spain than Tom Hall from the excellent Scottish football blog? Tom, we emailed earlier in the week. You said Scotland versus Spain could be a long night. I guess it didn't quite turn out how you expected it.
No, it was a long night for periods of the game. But a 2-0 down, Scotland rediscovered some pride, had a bit of a going, obviously got back to 2-0, which not many teams will do against Spain. There was a bit of pride restored on Tuesday night. Surprised me, the performance.
Obviously, let's take the Czech Republic game first. Craig Levein starting with no strikers on the pitch. That can't have really endeared him to the Scottish press very much.
The Scottish press, the Scottish fans, I've rarely seen such universal disapproval of a manager's decision. It was inexplicable, really. The Czech Republic are a solid team. They're not a spectacular team. They're certainly not the team they were a couple of years ago. And to give them such respect, they played without striker, just seems inexplicable. And I suppose the defeat was what the formation deserved, really. And Craig Green needs to take blame for that.
You have that performance against Spain. Do you think that's gone some way to restoring pride or at least restoring a little bit of faith? Or was it just a case of Scotland getting into gear and then, you know, just giving Spain a bit of a fright rather than actually any cause for optimism?
Well, it was much improved, so there's got to be optimism there. The unfortunate thing about that is we don't have another group game until this time next year. So any momentum that we might build up, I think, will be lost. This is a qualifying campaign. You need to do more than lose to the world champions to qualify.
And how do you feel your chances are for qualification? Third in the group, obviously played more than any other country, but still only 2 points behind the Czech Republic.
Yes, I think when we play our next game, we'll be behind the Czech Republic and Lithuania, you would expect, because they both play Liechtenstein before we play again. Who knows? If we can win all three games, we've Lithuania and the Czech Republic at home. We've got Liechtenstein away. If we can play like we played for 15 or so minutes against Spain, we will win all three. Play like we played against Lithuania, Liechtenstein and the Czech Republic, we might struggle in all.
Thanks there to Tom Hall from the Scottish Football Blog. Apologies for his connection. I think his Skype was just as depressed about Scotland's chances as some of the more pessimistic Scotland fans. Coming up in part two, we've got a lovely bit of MLS for you. And hey, how about a bit of Championship to whet your appetite? Part two of the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Welcome back. Chris Nee, MLS time. What are the talking points?
Pretty much the same talking points they have been for the last couple of weeks, really. The playoffs are almost set, and it really does now take a miracle from the Wizards in order for the eight to change. So they need to win their final two games, and they need the Rapids to lose their final two games in order for either of those two teams to change place. So we are essentially now, I think, looking at the Galaxy, Salt Lake, Red Bulls, Columbus, Dallas, Seattle, San Jose, and Colorado for the playoffs.
Have to be a fairly big collapse. I mean, Kansas did get off, well, not the get off to, because they lost to Seattle, but then winning against Chicago in midweek, that's vital. Gives them a slight lifeline.
It does give them a slight lifeline. I've not seen the fixtures for the final two games for those teams, but I believe it's actually not out of the question for those results to happen in the Wizards' favour. Well, but I don't think they're consistent enough to do it.
The Rapids have Galaxy as their next game, and the Wizards have the Revs.
So they should still be in it on the final day then.
Makes it, in theory. Keeps it a little bit interesting at any rate.
It does, and the Galaxy are starting to pick up results again. Because they seemed like they just kind of switched off for a few weeks, started to draw instead of win, but they're back out there trying to pick up some momentum for the playoffs.
Got a win over Philadelphia. Edson Buddle again.
Yeah, I think he's 16, 17 now. One of those two. I think he's in the box seat for the Golden Boot. Ahead of Chris Wondolowski, who scored two at the weekend as well. So he's breathing down his neck.
I guess big talking points from the weekend weren't so much those games, but red cards. DC and San Jose both having to play most of the game with 10 men.
Yes, somewhat unfairly. And I don't just say that as a DC fan. It was a clash underneath a high ball. It was very much off the ball between Jaime Moreno, who is now only equally top scorer of all time in MLS, and Brandon McDonald's of the Earthquakes. McDonald's. I'm getting all American. And Brandon McDonald of the Earthquakes, and not quite sure what happened. All you can really see on the sort of long distance shot replay is McDonald headbutting Moreno. So I think it's very clear that he deserved his red, but Moreno's involvement seems to be under question, and he certainly is protesting his innocence. And if he gets his ban extended, which, you know, if he didn't really do anything, I would suggest is probably unlikely, then that will be him for DC, because he's not coming back.
Oh dear. The other place with a couple of red cards, Houston finishing the game with 9 men, although both those red cards came in stoppage time.
Yeah, you probably argue that there's a little bit of frustration going on in Houston at the moment. They've had a really, really poor season after a fairly impressive one last year. They've lost some crucial players. They lost Rico Clark and Stuart Holden over the last preseason, which is a huge loss for a club like Houston. And Nguyenia and Jeff Cameron got sent off in stoppage time against the Revs. Jeff Cameron's was the clearest red card you will ever see. It was an absolute peach of a forearm smash on Pat Phelan, who pretty much clattered him in the first half, so it was an obvious revenge shot.
Nice. I guess the biggest fixture of the last round has turned out to be a slight damp squib with New York and Ralph Salt Lake goalless.
Yep, I heard the Salt Lake coach, Jason Kreis, being interviewed earlier this week, and he's very much of the opinion that he doesn't want to rest players and he wants to go into the playoffs on a high. And actually, you know, going to New York and getting a draw is not a bad result for them. So he's looking for wins still, despite the fact that they still are in with a shout at Supporters Shield. So that remained a big game, despite the fact that they are both in the playoffs. It wasn't really that much of an entertaining match. So I think we'll probably just chalk that one up to being a little bit tense and a little bit tight.
And Salt Lake have got Dallas, which is probably, well, in terms of respective table position, it's probably the pick of the top of table fixtures this weekend.
I think in all criteria, that is the most attractive game of the weekend. Two teams that I love watch playing football. They're both really exciting teams. They are obviously both excellent quality teams, and they're both right up there with a shout of doing something really special. So it should be a really cracking game, but it does also have that threat of being a little bit edgy as well.
Well, we'll keep an eye on the Rapids and the Wizards situation. Suspect it'll be next couple of weeks. We'll probably be whipping through MLS before we then get into the interesting part of the end of season playoffs. Luke, you mentioned just before we came on here that you used to coach over there.
I used to work for MLS soccer camps, correct? Yeah. I worked in Arizona and New Mexico and California for a summer after I finished university.
What was that like over there?
It was fantastic. Yeah, it was. It was really, really great. I mean, Arizona at the time was not. You wouldn't describe it as a hotbed of youth soccer. The East Coast tends to be a lot busier, a lot stronger for youth football. So some weeks we were sort of coaching two kids and their dog, and other weeks it was busier. But yeah, it was a great experience, and it was an eye opening experience in terms of the amount of kids that do play soccer, as they call it in the States. It was it was a fantastic experience, and still stunned that they don't produce an even better national team than they've got, and you know, hopefully they will in the next few years.
Well, it's there, the talent is there, and there is this kind of assumption over here that it's played only by middle class kids and it's played only by girls over there, and it's just not true. And the problem comes when these brilliant athletes, we know America is brilliantly talented at producing young athletes, but when they hit 14, 15 and they have to choose which sport they go for, they go for a native sport.
Yeah.
And there's the famous recent example is Chad Ochocinco, who's a very, very famous American footballer, and he played soccer as a kid, and he had to make that choice. He's a huge Arsenal fan. He's not really a huge Arsenal fan. He claims to be an Arsenal fan on the basis that he used to be invited over to watch by Thierry Henry. But he loves football, and he warms up before games by kicking a football up and down. And these are the kids that they're losing to the bigger American sports over there. So the talent is there, and it does play football at a young age, but they just lose them at teenage years.
On a slightly smaller scale, you could apply that to Wales as well. I'm not joking, actually.
Of course.
Obviously, rugby, very big pull over there. Probably you could apply it a little bit to Ireland as well, I suspect, with the Gaelic sports as well. But anyway, probably something for one of our Irish listeners to inform us on that, because I can't say I'm overly au fait with the Irish sporting situation. Anyway, while the MLS playoffs look sorted, let's go on to one of the most unpredictable and exciting leagues in the world, otherwise known as the Championship. I don't think I'm being particularly hyperbolic with that, because it's very exciting, unpredictable. Can't really call it any point in this stage of season. Luke, your team, Nottingham Forest, a lot of people had them down as the promotion hopefuls at the start of the season. You're currently in mid-table. Do you think that pre-season optimism was misguided?
I don't, in the sense that we are, as you say, mid-table, but as you also touched on, it's so unpredictable that we're not exactly miles off the playoffs. We're only 3 points off sixth position, and if I was a betting man, I would back Forest to get into the playoffs. I would back us to make it into the top six. The shape of our recent seasons, we're very much a confidence team. I know it's a cliche, but we are. Forest really do tend to go on runs, and we tend to go on runs of 10 games where we'll be unbeaten, or we'll virtually win every game. And I think we will go on a run. I think there have been a few problems in the last couple of months. I think that there have been a few rumbles of Davies being very unhappy with how he's being, with the treatment he's getting from the board. But no, I think that we'll be okay in the long run. And as I say, I would back us to make the playoffs this season still.
What is going on with the boardroom? Because obviously last season, so close to getting that promotion to the Premier League, didn't really sign many people over the summer. And the big talking point did seem to be Davies and, as you put it, that tension with the board.
Yeah, I mean, he feels. I have to be honest. I haven't got an inside track onto what's going on in the boardroom, unfortunately. But I do think he feels he's not being given enough support financially to invest in the team. They lost James Perch to Newcastle. He's been having a bit of a torrid time there, as you may have seen at times. But I think it's quite simply that he feels that there should be more opportunities to invest in the squad.
You have Barnsley this weekend away. What do you reckon that's going to turn out as? Any predictions?
Barnsley away. I think given our form so far, I'm almost certain it's going to be a draw. But we're going to start turning those draws into wins. And that's a serious point. I do. You know, we've only lost one game, and we've drawn a lot of games. And I think that we will, perhaps not this weekend, but there will be a time when the draws will be converted into 3 points.
Of course, at the top of the table, everybody talking about Queen's Park Rangers. This could be finally the season they return to the Premier League. Chris, Warnock's done a great job down there, hasn't he?
He has. It looks almost certain, I think, at this point, that they are going to be in with a shout at the end of the season. We mentioned in the bit that may or may not make it to the final cut, Mr. Jamie Mackie, who you know a lot more about than I do. But he's absolutely flying at the moment. He's kind of... I suppose he's not carrying them as much as being carried by the QPR wagon at the moment, and they are in storming form, still unbeaten, and clear at the top of the table already.
A lot of people talk about Warnock's abrasiveness. He's obviously a big character, but he seems to be able to handle Adil Taarabt, which is the key that a lot of other managers don't seem to have been able to do.
And crucial for them as well. A player of his talent in that league is always going to be an excellent player, and getting the best out of him. Neil Warnock, for all his little foibles, is a pretty decent manager, and his forte, I would say, is getting teams out of this league and into the Premier League. So he was the perfect choice for them. I thought so all along, and it looks as if it's going to pay off, and it'll be really interesting to see what they do financially if they do get up, because it's then that we're going to really see whether they intend to spend or not.
They're probably one of the very few teams who have the financial clout to, if they wish to, compete up there. Fascinating stuff. Other sort of fascinating areas in there. Luke, I mean, you've got two big name sides who've just come back into the Championship after a spell away, Norwich and Leeds. Norwich, fantastically well. They're sitting in third place. They're just one point off the automatic spots. Leeds, they're in 10th, but they're only 5 points behind. Are you surprised that those two teams have done so well, or do you think perhaps the standard, certainly for those teams who are big, they've got that big budget, it's not such a great leap?
I think it's a momentum thing. I think that it's a bit of a scrappy kind of every team for themselves league, and I think if you come into it with a bit of momentum, then it is possible to carry it on, because I think the overall, dare I say it, the overall standard of football is not massively high. It's that there's a lot of teams which are hard to beat and make themselves hard to beat, and I think if you come into that league with a bit of momentum, then it is possible to carry it on.
Absolutely. Also, a team who have clearly lost momentum after last season, Leicester City. All kinds of goings on there. Your boss is a Leicester City supporter.
That's correct.
Has he been sighing a lot more than usual?
Well, I've been off work this week, so thankfully I've not had to listen to the incessant sighing, which has been nice. But he, Eriksen is just, I don't know, it's just the most tiresome appointment, isn't it, really? From my point of view, anyway. I just think that he's not going to set the world alight, but I suppose he is a safe pair of hands and probably an expensive pair of hands.
Absolutely. Although, first signing, got to say, Cole Norton on loan from Spurs is not necessarily a bad signing for a club at that level.
Well, he's obviously a very capable manager for that level. It's just that he's been around the block so many times that I personally find it hard to get excited now when Eriksen takes a job anywhere.
As we mentioned, really tight. I mean, you could have any team go on a run and be up in the playoff spots. But Chris, Middlesbrough really, really haven't lived up to expectation. I had them down on two for the tackle at the start of the season, and I think I said Strachan will either walk away with the title, or they'll stumble, they'll stutter, they'll fall down the table, and Strachan will be out of a job come January. Do you think that second prediction of mine might be coming true?
Certainly looks like it, doesn't it? They're way down at the moment in 18th place, which is pretty appalling. It's a real fall from grace. The supporters up there aren't going to put up with it. I remember watching them chuck their season ticket to Steve McLaren, and they weren't doing too badly then, so God knows what it's like up there at the moment.
I've never understood that, throwing your season ticket at somebody, because it's just you're going to regret it in the morning, clearly. You're just going like, Saturday, bollocks, I'm going to have to pay.
I might make a sacrifice for Steve McLaren.
That's a bit harsh on Steve. Steve, surely.
It is. He remains a figure of fun for me, despite the fact that I have developed an immense respect for his quality as a coach and a manager.
Can I just say, if you ever want two-footed tackle to go on commercial radio, then you're going to have to cut out the swear words, Gary.
Probably the most attractive looking game in the Championship this weekend, the most fascinating one, is Middlesbrough against Leeds, which I think should be a bit of a cracker on there. Although, well, Middlesbrough need that win. Leeds in very good form. I would put your money on that one being one to watch. Like Queen's
QPR Park, Norwich as well.
Yeah,
it's good, doesn't it? Yeah.
Queen's Park Rangers and Norwich. That I would probably go for a home win on that. Although Norwich have a habit of pulling late goals out of the bag. And then two teams with utterly contrasting fortunes. I mean, we thought that Bristol City might well be up there, despite the presence of David James. And I think he's averaged something like three goals let in a game. Which move hasn't quite worked out from Dan Ashton Gate. Did either of you find it, obviously it's a while ago now, but did either of you find it slightly odd, the Steve Coppell situation of going in and then a couple of games later he was gone?
Yeah, I mean it was odd, and I think any club would struggle to contend with that. As their chairman said the other day, effectively their first 10 games of the season have been their pre-season because they had so much upheaval. Nicky Maynard is still out, isn't he? He's had knee surgery over the summer, so who was their top scorer last season, and I think they're missing him. And they're getting Sam Vokes back from Wolves, aren't they, the online guy. So I think that will help. But absolutely, any club would struggle. You feel a bit for David James, having been tempted down to the Championship by Coppell, only to see him leave days later. I think they'll be... I suspect that they'll fight their way out of it. But, yeah, who knows?
Mm. Well, we'll keep an eye. Pop back and forth the Championship over various courses of the season. I'm sure Terry, when he comes back, he might be able to tell us what he thinks about how Palace are doing, which at the moment is rather badly. Anyway, we'll leave it there for part two. That's all we've got time for. Stay tuned, though, for part three, where we look at the issue du jour of Liverpool, as well as something on the FA Cup to warm your cockles. Welcome back. Part three of the Two for the Tackle podcast. A quick look at the third qualifying round of the FA Cup. Chris, any ties that caught your eye in the last round?
I went to Kingstonian for a league game about 2 weeks ago, so I kept an eye on them, and they've had a fairly decent run in the FA Cup. But they ultimately have gone out to St Albans, lost at home in a replay, with the carrot of Luton dangling in front of them, which is a shame that they've missed out on that. But obviously a bit of a coup for St Albans.
Mm, absolutely, and at Kenilworth Road as well, so bound to be a big crowd there.
Yep, it would have been a cracking tie for Case, but St Albans go marching on, and they have that instead. And there are a few other games from the next round that I've had a bit of a look at. Paul Town still going, that we mentioned the last time we looked at this. The first team I ever went to see in non-league, and they've got a plum tie as well. They'll be at home to Hayes and Yedding.
Mm, a possible upset there, I would say.
It's possible. I would be incredibly surprised, but I suppose that is what an upset is.
Absolutely. Any other ones that caught your eye from there?
Met Police managed to beat Wealdstone, so they'll be away to Hendon. And Carshalton as well will have a big tie. A team that we've kind of had a look at throughout the cup run has been Chelmsford, and they will be up against Carshalton. So that'll be a decent tie, and possibly an upset there as well.
Yeah, Chelmsford requiring a replay to get past Bromley. My Bromley supporting friend was at the game and just left a note on his Facebook state saying he was furious with Bromley's performance. But then he's generally furious with most people's performances. Mm. Isn't Hendon where the police training college is?
I think so.
It's police derby, essentially.
Yeah, and it would have been obviously a bit of a derby against Wealdstone as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, there are a few others. There's a lot of kind of in division games, aren't there? There's a lot of Blue Square Bet Premier ties that are just, so is it the lower leagues are going to be well represented in the first round by the looks of it.
Absolutely. Obviously the plum tie, you've got to say, in terms of, although the real FA Cup, when I was speaking to them on Twitter earlier, said this is basically the Manchester United versus Liverpool of the FA Cup fourth qualifying round, which is Newport County against big spending Crawley Town on there. And I think most neutrals would rather see the home side, the Exiles, Newport, triumph there, given Steve Evans's position as manager of Crawley. We haven't really got time to get into Steve Evans, and we probably don't have the lawyers.
Not willing.
Either. No. The other one that I've picked out, Kettering against Rushton. Nice local derby.
Derby, yeah.
Mm. Which that one
they're doing all right, Kettering under their new boss, aren't they? Is he caretaker still?
No, No, Morel Mason is not. I've forgotten who the manager is there now. It's definitely not Morel Mason.
No, is the new guy who's been properly appointed. I can't remember. Marcus Law.
Marcus Law. Oh, yes, of course. Had a fantastic record down with his team. I think they went over a year unbeaten. I've completely forgotten the name of the team, so you can tell how good my research has been today. Elsewhere, once. Game that I think could be quite interesting is the game that's on Sunday, which is FC United of Manchester against Barrow. Barrow, obviously, great cup team in the last few years. They played Middlesbrough and they've very good over one game, slightly inconsistent in the league. FC United of Manchester obviously will be looking to get into the first round. That, to me, I think could be one of the most interesting ties around. The real FA Cup, I asked them, they've picked out Carl Shelton game as well. Mm-hmm. On that, they also said they wouldn't mind the Sheffield game as well.
Yeah, that's just a draw every round, though, isn't it, Sheffield? And most of us would like to get there at some point.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah, a few, all Blue Square Bet Premier games, all the conference, first career. Kidderminster against York, Tamworth against Grimsby. Should be quite fun, both those. Not a Blue Square Premier game, but Halifax against Mansfield. Halifax, obviously, a big name down there, despite going bust a few years ago. Mansfield could be a very interesting tie. Again, that one on there. Some great stuff. If you're going to a game, do let us know which one. If there's anyone that you particularly want to get through, or maybe you're a Football League fan, you're looking through there. Any teams you particularly fancy a nice away day to? I can particularly recommend Nuneaton, who I think are still in it. Nuneaton Town, they're away at Workington, so rather long trip up for them. But if you get drawn away to Nuneaton, Exeter were there last season, I had a fantastic time. Probably very rare that you'll ever hear, I had a fantastic time in Nuneaton. uttered absolutely anywhere.
Wouldn't mind working Bournemouth.
Working Bournemouth? Yeah, I have two places you have a connection for.
Well, working is just close to home.
Mm. So yeah, you've been there, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, been there a lot. I've been to see them as well. But I have no great affection for the football club. It would be an easy trip for me to finally go to a Bournemouth game that isn't just all their kids getting spanked by Tooting.
If you want the water derby, you could call this one. I've just noticed Swindon Supermarine versus Bath City.
Terrible.
Okay, from the sublime or the ridiculous indeed to the further ridiculous, namely Liverpool. Not the club itself, but the off-field shenanigans. And Luke, events in the court today regarding Liverpool's ownerships, they're moving so fast, probably what we say now is likely to be out of date even in the next few hours. But so far, what's been your take on the current battles in the courtroom?
Well, so far, my take is that I don't think anyone really knows what's going on. And I think it's all so complicated legally. There was this story that Hicks had actually sold his share of the club to Mill Financial, the hedge fund, who also owned Gillette shares, which turned out to be untrue. Mr. Lim has withdrawn his offer. I think it seems to me that Hicks, in particular, Tom Hicks, is just trying to put any obstacle in the way that he can of this NESV deal going through, or a deal that he and George Gillette do not approve of. In a way, for the neutral, it's kind of an entertaining thing to, you know, there's been the live blogs online the last couple of days, and in a way I suppose it's entertaining, but I don't know. I just want it to be over now and for it to be resolved one way or the other. And I think the other quite funny thing in all of this is that all this money that's owned to the Royal Bank of Scotland, and Royal Bank of Scotland threatening to put the club into administration, but the Royal Bank of Scotland themselves had to be bailed out by the British government because they nearly went under. So, you know, it's a crippled institution trying to get control of another crippled institution, unfortunately.
Chris, I guess the big question is tomorrow, or as you'll be listening to this, good listener, on Friday is deadline day for the repayment. RBS do have the power to put Liverpool, or Kop Holdings, the parent company, into administration. The judge today in the High Court has ruled that basically the Texas injunction must be removed by 4 o'clock tomorrow, which is pretty much the deadline for RBS putting it into administration. Can RBS, or should RBS, be putting Liverpool into administration with all these potential sales? They're so close to the sale. would it really hurt to extend it for a few more days if it means sorting out the legal perspective rather than just Hicks and Gillette delaying?
I can't see them going for administration at this point. I think without NESV on the scene, that would be a likely course of action. But it seems like it's really close. It seems very much like Hicks is just clinging on for dear life. And there seems to be a certain amount of bitterness in his actions at the moment. I don't think any of them are truly intended at keeping hold of the club, because I think if he's got his wits about him, he will have written off that idea already. So I don't think it would be prudent to go for administration for a company that's owed lots of money by the football club. And I suspect that they will allow the sale to go through. I think the only thing that seems relatively clear is that eventually the NESV sale is probably going to be the end one that goes through.
Mm, absolutely. Unlikely heroes in the chairman, Martin Broughton, and the other two directors.
Didn't they lap
as well.
It up outside the court yesterday as well?
I think you probably would. You know, it's your one chance of glory. You're never probably going to get anything like that in your life again. I think I would, if I'm honest. And especially given the pleasure of rubbing... clearly, it's all that war between Hicks and Gillette. The pleasure of rubbing their noses in. Obviously... You know, we can't really speculate whether Liverpool will or won't go into administration. But Luke, in the wider term of Liverpool, this doesn't reflect particularly well on the Premier League, does it? Because here's one of their big global brands. This is, you know, to all intents and purposes, one of the flagship clubs of the Premier League, loved all over the world, a global icon of a club all over the world that's nearly gone into administration under the Premier League's watch. They said Portsmouth was a one-off. Hey, we've got Liverpool come along again.
I find it almost hard to put into words how badly this reflects on the Premier League and their attitude to their business. And the point has been made before, but you only have to look at a project like the 49th game, or is it the 45th game? Hang on. The project to take the Premier League overseas anyway. I think that there are huge problems that we're seeing them being played out now. But you cannot allow people to buy clubs, or not even buy clubs. You know, I mean, Glazer didn't buy United. Glazer took out a huge loan and said, right, you know, I mean, it's exactly what Hicks and Gillette did. You know, to buy these leveraged deals where you plunge the club into this ridiculous debt. And you know, look across to Old Trafford and David Gill continually banging the drum that this isn't a problem, the fact that we're having to service these enormous debts. Well, I'm sorry, but it clearly is a problem, because Manchester United would have made an operating profit of around £100 million last year, which was utterly wiped out and turned into a 80-odd million loss by the fact that they're having to service all this debt. So, absolutely, I think that, not to put it too strongly, but the Premier League would have blood on their hands if, God forbid, a team like United or Liverpool actually went under, which is not, you know, so far from the bounds of possibility given their financial situations.
Chris, what really needs to be done? Because the Premier League, very much like the free market ideology, let them get on with it. You know, we'll have these in as long as they're fit and proper people, which, well, frankly, is not a hard test to pass at the moment. But what needs to be done?
Well, a fit and proper person's test has to take into account these kind of characters.
Should it be looking a lot closer at the financial backing behind it, not just ethically, yeah, not just whether they've got fraud, but finances?
They should look at that, and if there were any way of making sure of their intentions, obviously there isn't, but that would be ideal as well. But free market, EU, all of that stuff, this is football, and ultimately the Premier League can stop these teams coming in if they want to do it. The leveraged loans, this has to stop. It just does. The free market, it was Dave Boyle said today, the free market for football as a business model, it just doesn't work, and it hasn't worked. And Man United and Liverpool, and it is Man United, they are in a dire situation, whatever you say about it.
And what happened in Portsmouth as well was just a shambles. It just makes the Premier League, actually, I think, look deeply stupid that they allow this stuff to go on. Portsmouth was just a perverse situation where you had, you know, anonymous buyers and people coming in and owning the club for a couple of months and then deciding they wanted out, and it was just ridiculous. And it seems that, I don't know the answer. How, you know, what needs to be done? How do they stop it? I'm not exactly sure, but they have to stop it somehow.
Well, ultimately, whatever. If anybody decides that they want to buy a club, on what is legal, these loans, you know, this isn't a really kind of, it's possibly arguably, you know, unethical, but it's not illegal.
Yeah.
And therefore, any kind of blocks on that would face a huge challenge from anybody who is really determined to buy a club. And that obviously poses a problem for the Premier League. But at the moment, they don't even pretend to be interested in tackling it anyway. So it's a really difficult situation. But I think eventually you have to hope that someone up there is going to begin to separate football from business. And I know that doesn't work in the real world. But when it comes to who's taken over football clubs and how they finance that, then you have to accept that these clubs are different to the ordinary business.
And I also think the problem for a team like Manchester United is that these problems aren't going to go away quickly, you know, because the credit crunch and the global financial crisis has changed the landscape so much that people like Gillette or Hicks, I mean, and to a lesser extent the Glazers, are running into serious problems. And how United dig themselves out of that financial hole that they are now in, I really don't know, because who's going to be willing to come in and wipe out that amount of debt? It's a phenomenal amount of money, and I don't think I would be staggered if someone came in, and because that's one of the good things for Liverpool is at least some of these deals do seem to offer the hope of wiping out the debt that is currently saddled on the club.
I was going to say as well, I mean, this isn't necessarily leverage bias, but then you look down the list of Premier League teams. Let's not forget West Ham have actually, or their parent company had a spell in administration, but they weren't docked points because it was perhaps a little bit more complex on what was going on there. And so you've got West Ham, Newcastle have had various financial problems, which arguably are still ongoing as well. Then you look into the Championship as well. You've got Hull, who have financial difficulties as well, overspending for the Premier League. You have Burnley, who spent a ridiculous proportion. I think it was something like, I might be wrong on this, I'm going from memory, but something like about 109% of their turnover went on to wages last season in the Premier League.
God,
which is
make even Martin O'Neill's eyes water, that would.
Unsustainable. Wigan also, I don't think they're quite 100%. I think they're around about 99-97% of their turnover goes on wages in the Premier League.
It's just completely unsustainable, isn't it? And people have been saying it for several years, but it is unsustainable.
Absolutely. Should we get back to some football?
Good idea.
Let's. Okay. Well, we'll stick with Liverpool, though, because Merseyside derby this weekend, Luke. Last season would have probably been a competition for Europa League, even fourth Champions League qualifying spot. At the moment, Liverpool sit 18th, Everton sit 17th.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult match to call that, I think, because, you know, the situation, I mean, there's two schools of thought. One is that Liverpool, the players shouldn't necessarily be affected by what goes on in the boardroom or in the courtroom. I don't buy into that at all. And in fact, a lot of players have come out and said, this is affecting us, this is affecting morale, and it is affecting the atmosphere around the team, and has been for quite a while. Pepe Reina came out the other day and said that. I mean, it's a tough one to call, but I would back Everton, although they have, I think they've got a fantastic midfield, but they do struggle for goals. But I wouldn't be surprised to see them either Everton nick a narrow win or that one to finish in a draw.
I can bet you that it'll have a red card in there somewhere.
Do you think?
The previous history in the Merseyside derby.
It's highly charged, isn't it? As always, yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe so.
Chris, Villa have got Chelsea this weekend. You're at Villa Park.
I will be at Villa Park.
How do you rate the chances?
Well, kind of the same as I do before most times we play Chelsea at the moment, and that is that I just can't see us getting a result. But every now and then we just do. We beat them at home last year. Obviously it didn't go so well at Wembley or at Stamford Bridge for us last season. But we've got a fairly good record. In fact, we've got an incredible record against Chelsea at home over the last 11 or so years. So there's an undercurrent of confidence, but I'm not going to pay it any mind.
Okay. Luke, has there ever been a better time for a West Bromwich Albion team full of confidence to play Manchester United, a team that don't look quite as confident as they have done?
Good question. There's this great story that's broken this morning or overnight is about Wayne Rooney and his ankle, and is he injured or is he not injured, and Alex Ferguson. I mean, the idea that Alex Ferguson could be slightly economical with the truth about one of his players' fitness is just so outlandish, isn't it? It's a very, very interesting story, this thing about Rooney, because a lot of people seem to be jumping on the, oh my God, you know, Fergie's going to be so angry that he's going to sell him at the earliest opportunity. which I don't buy into. But yeah, getting back to your initial question, United, I think, have been scraping by now for 18 months. I don't think they've been playing well. I think that they did fantastically well to stay, you know, in the race for the title as long as they did last season. I think that to get back to the business side of things that we were talking about, you know, they claim that they've got money to spend, and if they have got money to spend, I think Fergie is getting his policy wrong on putting so much faith in the young players that they have coming through the club, because and also relying on the older guys like Giggs and Scholes, because if you want to stay at the top, if you want to be one of the world's most successful clubs and compete with the likes of Chelsea and compete with the likes of Barcelona, then it doesn't matter, you know, where the players are or how much they're going to cost. You buy them, and you blow people out of the water with your financial clout, because that's how you have to operate. And United aren't operating like that at the moment.
You need to have Giggs and Scholes in their pomp. Those players,
that's right,
those
yeah.
players are out there, and they are players that Man United previously might have bought. At the moment, you've got in their 30s Giggs and Scholes, and but both of them having a reasonable season. Both of them were pretty decent last season, but you're not going to get another top level season out of them.
And I also think that you're not even going to get a full week in week out. See, this season, I don't think you can ask those guys to play week in week out.
And let us not forget as well, West Bromwich Albion playing some wonderful football, I think, and defeating Arsenal as well. Recently. So Manchester United, be warned. Chris, staying in the Midlands, down the bottom of the table, Wolves versus West Ham.
Six pointer.
Wolves in terrible form at the moment.
Yeah, they've been slightly under the cosh from the media as well. So I don't know if that's one of those factors like Liverpool that is probably distracting to the players on the pitch. I can't see it affecting McCarthy's team talks one jot, but it should be a really interesting game, because these are both teams that, although you know they're in their almost in their alphabetical positions even, but they're probably a little bit better than their form is suggesting. So it should be a good game. Wolves possibly have the potential to stifle it a little bit, but I can't see too much between them, so it should be fairly even, and with their defences there might be a couple of goals as well.
We'll just quickly run through the other bits and pieces, because we're running out of time a little bit, but very quickly, Luke, Arsenal versus Birmingham is another interesting fixture. The Blues obviously losing their unbeaten home run, they're now away. Arsenal need to get back on track with a good win. Where do you see that one going?
I think Arsenal will win, and I think it's one of those ones actually that Arsenal could win quite comfortably, because I think they'll overwhelm Birmingham at home, and I think they'll be able to they'll be able to play their game. I mean, I think Birmingham will give them a good run, but no, I think Arsenal will win that.
Chris, Fulham, Tottenham.
I would love to think home win, but I can't see it.
Draw.
I think Tottenham will be just about too strong for them. Fulham are decent at home, but I think Spurs will have too much.
I'm going draw.
Well, you always win these, so
Fulham will win 2-1. They always win 2-1 at home.
They've got a good record, I think, against Spurs. Just going from the back of my head, they've got a good record at home against Spurs rather than away. I think some Fulham fans might want to correct me on that, but that's again going from memory.
They'll be quiet about it, don't worry.
Probably one for the purists is Bolton against Stoke.
One for the purists.
I'm quite looking forward to that game.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you a purist?
Maybe I am. I wouldn't have identified myself as such, but I'm genuinely
self-confessed purist now.
Actually looking forward to that game. I'm not even joking.
Excellent. Right. You're talking about that next week then.
I hope it's as exciting as I'm foreseeing.
Wonderful. Newcastle against Wigan. I would put that down as a Newcastle win, because I think they have the potential to be a very good side when they're hooked up together. Although Wigan, who knows what team's going to turn up. Blackpool against Manchester City could be fun.
Away win.
You reckon?
Yeah, I think they're playing well at the moment.
About 6-3,
isn't
it?
They don't have too much. I don't think they'll stick six past them, because I don't think that's the nature of the Manchester City beast. But I think that I've been completely won over to Blackpool's feats in the Premier League this season, despite our playoff woe against them. I applaud Holloway and what they've done so far, but I think Man City are looking increasingly strong, and I think they'll have too much for them.
And Chris, is this one that you're looking forward to as well? Blackburn against Sunderland?
No.
One for the purists?
Yeah, definitely one for the purists, and I think that one will be absolutely dire.
Okay, and we'll leave it there. Just a quick plug for a few of Two Footed Tackle's various offerings. Please, please, please do go along to justgiving.com/Two Footed Tackle. Our chosen charity, Cry, which is cardiac. You should know this.
Cardiac Risk in the Young.
Thank you.
They aim to raise awareness of the underlying heart conditions that can lead to sudden cardiac death and sudden death syndrome.
It's a really, really important charity, even though I temporarily forgotten the name, which I've been doing a lot of this evening. I can't remember various FA Cup results, and you know that's meant to be my speciality. But please do go along, justgiving.com/two-footed-tackle. We are aiming to raise, give them a Christmas present of £1,000.
It's not looking good.
It's early days. It's early days. Please do go along, even if it's just £2. But please just give what you can to this cause, and hopefully we can make it a very happy Christmas for Cry. Twitter.com/two-footed-tackle to get in touch with Chris over Twitter. Facebook.com/two-footed-tackle if you wish to become a fan of the pod and the website in general. www.twofootedtackle.com. Some, as always, entertaining stuff on there. Do go along if you're not a fan of Harry Redknapp, because Chris is not a fan of Harry Redknapp either and has written about it. There's a surprise. Podcast@twofootedtackle.com if you want to get in touch with us. Luke, thanks very much.
Thank you
for watching any football this weekend at all, or in from the sofa?
This weekend, will I be watching football? No, I'll be cycling somewhere a long way away this weekend. I'm sure I'll watch Match of the Day, but other than that, no.
That's your other great passion.
Indeed so. Well, one of many passions, cycling, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I remember running off the Tour de France last year.
That's right, yeah.
Lucky bugger. Chris, where are you this weekend?
I'll be at Villa Park for the Chelsea game on Saturday, and I will probably take in an Italian game when I'm back on Sunday.
Wonderful stuff. I might, if I've got time, be nipping down to Wimbledon this weekend. Why not?
Sutton tooting.
Tempting. Trophy. FA Trophy game, isn't it? Or
It is,
yeah, FA Trophy game. And do look out for 6 picks on twofootedtackle.com, because I'll be picking out a trophy game in there. A county derby, no less, which I don't think's actually been played before. It's slightly obscure, but then you'd expect nothing less from me. We'll catch you same time next week. Thanks very much.
Twofootedtackle.com.